You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. There's a measure that is now in the General Assembly that would deal with some of the issues here in Northwest Indiana involving Lake Michigan access. And we have an organization that is helping the Save the Dunes organization in Northwest Indiana with this particular issue. Jeff Hyman is a senior staff attorney for the Conservation Law Center. They're based in Bloomington near the IU campus, and they, on a regular basis, help provide legal counsel to organizations like conservation groups like Save the Dunes. And Jeff is with us to talk about this current measure that is working through the General Assembly and the concerns we have up here in Northwest Indiana about having the proper access to Lake Michigan. Jeff, thank you for joining us on Regionally Speaking today.
Well, thanks for inviting me. It's good to be with you.
Well, first, if you will talk a little bit about the Conservation Law Center and how you folks there at the center got involved with the case up here in Northwest Indiana.
Well, the Conservation Law Center is actually, although we are affiliated with IU Moore School of Law in Bloomington, we are an independent nonprofit law firm that specializes in representing environmental groups in conservation matters. But we do teach a clinic here for law students, and so the Moore School of Law provides our offices and computers and so forth, and we're integrated into the law school as either adjunct faculty or faculty. But we do retain our independence in the cases we take and the matters that we decide.
When you were asked by the Save the Dunes organization to help in this particular case, you obviously had to do some homework. And what did you find that interested you folks at the Conservation Law Center about this project that is now a bill that is in the Indiana House of Representatives that deals with the lakefront access here in Northwest Indiana?
Well, we've been in this subject matter since 2013. That's when the Gunderson case got started, and we were asked by two organizations, Save the Dunes, of course, but also Alliance for the Great Lakes. They're based in Chicago. Both of those groups asked us to represent them in the litigation that was just getting started over who owns the beach, which involves the public trust doctrine and equal footing doctrine and a lot of legal doctrines that people haven't really heard of, but we knew that they were very important from the conservation perspective. So we wanted to be involved in those cases to be able to shape the law as it was developing in Indiana. And so we went through all the litigation. It actually went to the U.S. Supreme Court, which denied cert in that case. Mm-hmm. But we've been in that case since 2013. And now that the Gunderson decision occurred in 2018, and then we resolved the petition for certiorari in the U.S. Supreme Court, that was denied. And now there are continual attempts to undermine the holding of Gunderson because it was favorable for my clients and the state, but it was not favorable for the beachfront landowners that brought the suit in the beginning. So there's a continual attempt to shape and undermine that decision, and one of these attempts is legislation. And so last year there was very similar legislation that never made it out of committee, and this year they're trying again with this bill we're going to talk about, 1031, House Bill 1031.
Yeah. This is a measure, by the way, that was sponsored by State Representative Doug Miller from Elkhart. He has apparently an interest in this matter. Tell us first a little bit about the bill that Representative Gunderson has put out there, and perhaps a little bit about why he seems to be most interested.
There are ideological positions at stake in this litigation. This is the Gunderson litigation. And this bill, which comes out of that and attempts to undermine it and overturn it, it's all part of actually a national movement to privatize public lands. And the Gunderson Court ruled that the lake shore below the natural ordinary high water mark is public trust land. And that irks some people ideologically because some people believe that land should be in private hands as much as possible. So it's part of a nationwide ideological battle. I would call it a battle.
Mm-hmm.
And it's played out all over the country. And this is the manifestation of that national debate for Indiana. It's being played out on the lakeshore. Now, Miller's bill, so I can't speak to why Representative Miller was keen on introducing this. Probably he was asked to do something by the beachfront landowners. They spoke in favor of the bill at the hearing the other day at the State House. Any statements I might make about his motivation or the motivation of the people behind this beyond what I've said would be sheer speculation. Mm-hmm. So, but I can tell you what the bill is attempting to do. The bill attempts to basically relinquish state ownership of the lakeshore, especially in Section 10 of the bill. It explicitly says that the state will relinquish its ownership of the shore of Lake Michigan. But it goes beyond, so that would give away some of the most valuable property that exists in Indiana, which is the lakeshore, for no reason. And I can't see any reason for giving that shore away. But it goes beyond trying to give away ownership, state ownership of the shore. It actually tries to extinguish the public's rights to use the lakeshore, and that was a key holding of the Gunderson decision. Gunderson Court, the Indiana Supreme Court, explicitly said that below the natural ordinary high water mark on the shore of Lake Michigan, the public has an inalienable right to use that shore at minimum for walking, fishing, commerce, and navigation, and that the legislature could, if it wanted, expand those uses to other recreational uses. So just to recap what I've just said, not only is the bill trying to give away the state's ownership of the shore, it's trying to give away the public's rights to use the shore.
I know that Mr. Miller, in some comments that he made to Dan Carden, who's a reporter for the Times of Northwest Indiana, about this House Bill 1031, was that he says that there are already provisions, properties that are available, public properties available, that give citizens the right to the access to the lakefront. And this, I guess he says that there's already those access points right there now, and that it doesn't have to be more. That is, in this case, this private property.
Well, there are two points to be made there.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, the lakeshore is not private property. So it's not a matter of we need to find a balance between private property on the shore and public beaches on the shore. The fact is that, as the Gunderson Court recognized, for over 150 years, the federal courts and the state courts have said that at statehood, when states like Indiana became states, and for Indiana that was 1816, when they became states, they automatically acquired the shores of their navigable water bodies below the natural ordinary high water mark. And there's no dispute that Lake Michigan is a navigable water body. So Indiana has owned this lakeshore, all of the lakeshore, all 42 to 45 miles of it, from 1816, from the moment it became a state. There's no way that there could be private ownership except if the state gave or conveyed parcels of that state land to private owners. And that was done for industries such as U.S. Steel. So there are certain parcels along the lakeshore which early on, back in the 20th century, were given to these industries to promote industrial development on the lakeshore. But there are no landowners. There are no private beachfront landowners that own this state land. There's never been any transfer. There's never been any evidence that there's been any transfer of the state property to these private landowners. So if Representative Miller is saying that there is that these beachfront landowners actually own the shore below the ordinary high water mark, that is absolutely false as a matter of law, and we have an Indiana Supreme Court decision that says so. A second point there about what you said, not only is there no private ownership, but it is true that there are so-called public beaches on the lakeshore, but this is a matter of respecting the rule of law. So what Representative Miller is trying to do is not respect private property. He's trying to give away valuable state property to private landowners for their own private use. And that's prohibited by law, by Indiana law, as affirmed by the Gunderson decision. So and let me just say, we have problems on the lakeshore. There's no doubt about that. We have erosion problems. We have beaches that are being eroded away without being accreted because of jetties and so forth, stopping the natural movement of sand. We have homes that at high water are being undermined by strong storms and wave action, that these homeowners naturally want to protect their homes. And we have conflicts with the beachfront landowners and the backlot landowners of these towns along the lakeshore. This is, you know, human nature. People who buy on the beachfront don't want to see a lot of activity of the public in front of their house. So there are problems that should be solved, that need to be solved. But giving away our public trust lakeshore to private ownership is not the way to solve those problems. Those problems need to be solved in lawful ways. What Representative Miller is attempting to do is to basically have an easy fix for those serious problems by just giving it away, but it's unlawful to do that.
I understand that in the comments that Representative Miller made to Dan Cardin of the Times about this measure, that he says that he would just try to get both sides together to talk about it and come up with some kind of solution. And I guess even the chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, Jerry Torr of Carmel, felt the same way, too, when this all came up. And I know there's more discussion that's expected later this month as well, too, from the committee and perhaps even going to some kind of vote in the House sometime during the legislative session. But I get the impression from the comments made that this is obviously not going to be an issue that is going to be resolved during this particular legislative session.
Well, you're right. I mean, the problems that I just laid out for you, which I think are the three main problems, mm-hmm. Beach erosion, houses being washed over by strong storms at high water because they were essentially built too close to the shore to begin with in the olden days before there were buffers, and this, you know, kind of dispute between backlot owners and beachfront landowners. These three issues are not going to be solved this year. They've been going on for decades, but, you know, governments and private organizations and citizens need to really get together and solve these problems, but it's going to take compromise. But what I'm saying is that giving away the shore in a way that's contrary to the rule of law that we have in Indiana is not the way to solve those problems. And so I agree with anyone who says that we have these problems and that they need to be solved. I agree with that 100%. What I am disagreeing with is that this bill does not solve or even attempt to solve those problems. This bill basically just gives away state land and public land and public rights to use the shoreland into private ownership. and that is unlawful under the current law in Indiana.
Well, it looks like this is a matter that is likely not to be resolved this session, even if the bill does come up for some type of review or vote or whatever later in the General Assembly session. And as you say, it's not going to be an issue that's going to be quickly resolved to begin with. But we certainly appreciate you bringing up the ideas and your argument about this whole issue and your support through the Conservation Law Center for organizations like Save the Dunes about the concern about lakefront properties access by anybody, as it should be. And we thank you very much for spending time with us to talk about the issue today. I hope that we'll have a chance to check back with you later in the legislative session and see how you feel about how this whole matter's progressing.
Sure, I'd be happy to, and I appreciate your time.
Well, you're welcome. Jeff Hyman is a senior staff attorney with the Conservation Law Center based with the Indiana University School of Law in Bloomington. They provide legal counsel for organizations like Save the Dunes, and they are concerned about the measure that is now in the General Assembly, sponsored by State Representative Doug Miller of Elkhart, about the access to Lake Michigan. You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. It's time once again for Green Fleet Radio, and here's your host, Carl Lissick.
Well, thank you for that introduction. Today, our guest is Mr. Charles Breitenfeld. He's the Partners for Clean Air Coordinator for the Indiana Department of Environmental Management's Northwestern Indiana Regional Office. Charles, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks, Carl. It's good to be here.
So tell our listeners, what is Partners for Clean Air?
So Partners for Clean Air is a coalition of Northwest Indiana businesses, industries, and local governments and community groups that are committed to improving overall air quality and public health through voluntary actions.
So how does membership work, and who can be a partner?
Well, anyone and everyone can be a partner of the Partners for Clean Air program. We currently have members that are as small as one individual, and that goes all the way up to as companies as large as GAF in Michigan City, NIPSCO, we all know, and Metro Recycling in this area. It doesn't matter how big or small you are. If we combined all of our efforts together, it'll all add up to cleaner air.
I've always loved that tagline.
Yeah, it's very catchy. I mean, it all adds up cleaner, and it's so true. Yeah, if you want to sign up, it's really easy. You go to our Partners for Clean Air webpage. It's part of the IDEM website. And right there, there's a little bubble right on the right-hand side of the page. It says sign up for Partners for Clean Air, and it pulls up a nice state form for you. You can sign up as an individual or an organization. And then you just kind of fill in some basic information. And then the real meat of it comes in when it says to choose your different level of membership.
I see.
Yeah, we have four different levels of membership. We have gold, silver, bronze, and green. Mm-hmm. And those different memberships require you to do different things. Like gold and silver level memberships, you sign up to do 6 and 4 voluntary air actions, respectively, for that category, and they're listed right below that. There's 52 of them that you can choose from, so you have quite the options. And if you don't find anything you like there, you can create your own.
Mm-hmm.
So that's pretty convenient.
Very user-friendly, right?
Very user-friendly. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we try to make it as easy as possible. The gold and silver level memberships do also require some monetary or in-kind commitment to our program, as we are 100% funded by our members. So the more members we have, the more stuff we can do, the more we can get our name out there and educate the public. And those members for that commitment get to go on our steering committee that we meet every month on the second Friday of the month, and we get together and go over the things that we're trying to do. Regardless of what level membership you are, you still get a vote, and we vote for awards and other things like that. So everybody gets the vote and gets to know what's going on in our coalition. But the gold and silver level members are the real driving force of our coalition.
So why is it important for folks to work to keep air pollution down in our region, Charles?
Well, there's so many important things for it. I mean, air pollution can harm everybody. You know, it can be really dangerous for a lot of different people. And that includes children, teens, people with asthma or other lung diseases, anyone over the age of 65. If you like to exercise outside or you work outdoors, you know, if you have like diabetes or cardiovascular diseases like high blood pressure, all the air pollution affects all those different people. It's hard to get your message across in a short time like this, but we humans on average breathe about 14,000 liters of air per day. And just think.
That's a lot of air.
That's a lot of air, yes. And, when we have air pollution in our area, all those different contaminants that are in the air affect things. You know, they affect our lungs, they affect our heart, and if we have too much of those different things, it can cause headaches, cardiovascular disease, or asthma. You know, so that's a big thing, especially here in like Lake and Porter counties, mm-hmm. where we were recently designated as serious non-attainment. You know, so we really have to pay close attention, especially during those ozone action days. You know, from the months of March 1 through October 31st, it's really important that we pay attention to those things and make sure we do anything and everything we can to keep ozone-depleting substances from entering our atmosphere during those days.
So what are some of the ways you help spread the word about the importance of clean air initiatives?
Well, we love to do outreach events. We're, mm-hmm. I think we did like 20-something outreach events last year through our office, and Partners for Clean Air is always a big part of that. We have a cool event coming up here on January 18th. We're going to be at the Valparaiso University men's basketball game. We're going to have a booth there, so you can come up. We're right next to the concession stand, so you can learn all about clean air while you're waiting in line for your popcorn or your soda. And you can also sign up. We're giving away 4 bikes.
So wonderful.
That's really, yeah.
So no cost to enter any of these drawings. Just show up.
Yep. You just have to buy a ticket to watch the game. Other than that, there's no other cost. Yep.
So I know that the steering committee is also working on a new scholarship program. So tell our listeners a little bit about what that is about.
Oh, well, this is something we're super excited about, Carl. I mean, this is the first time we're doing this. A lot of people have put a lot of work into it. We're giving away at least one $2,500 scholarship. We're awarding it during this scholarship season. It's to any senior that's at a Lake, Porter, or LaPorte County High School. You have to be in one of those districts. You have to have a GPA of cumulative GPA of 2.5, be attending an Indiana accredited college or university in the fall of, of 2020, and be pursuing a 2-year, 4-year college degree or a 2-year trade school. So we didn't want to leave out the trade schools, certification or degree. And that, you know, we want you to tell us what you plan on doing with those degrees or certificates to help produce clean air or help limit the amount of pollution here in Northwest
Indiana. That is just a wonderful attribute to Partners for Clean Air.
Oh, it's awesome. We're very, very excited
Absolutely.
About it.
So how can people learn more about the Partners for Clean Air program?
So they can go to our website we have a Facebook and LinkedIn pages, Partners for Clean Air, Northwest Indiana on Facebook and LinkedIn. And then we also have our website, which is www.in.gov/partnerships. /item/partnerships. Mm-hmm. And you go there, there's a Partners for Clean Air tab right there. You click on it, and we have all of our links, all of our notifications, upcoming events, and there's also links to different things that you can help do to reduce air pollution here in Northwest Indiana.
So, folks, what Charles is telling you, this is a great way for you to make a huge, significant impact on the quality of air and the quality of life here in Northwest Indiana. And we'd welcome more new members to get involved with the Partners for Clean Air program. Charles, thank you so much for being on the show today. And that will do it for today's edition of Green Fleet Radio. Thank you again to Charles Breitenfeld, Partners for Clean Air Coordinator for the Indiana Department of Environmental Management's Northwestern Indiana Regional Office. Green Fleet Radio airs 3 times each Wednesday on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm your host, Carl Lissick. Thanks for joining us. And remember, it's never too late to begin your environmental legacy.
Green Fleet Radio is made possible by South Shore Clean Cities and the Northwestern Indiana Regional Planning Commission. And you can hear Green Fleet Radio every Wednesday here on Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. The Hoosier State is not just any old flyover state, as some folks out east or out west like to call it. There's a reason that Indiana is called the Crossroads of America. And to find out more, we have the best places to live in Indiana for 2020 list out this week. And that's coming out from homesnacks.net. And with us to talk about the list and where Lake County and Northwest Indiana communities fit into that, we have Nick Johnson, who is with homesnacks.net. And Nick, thank you for joining us today on Regionally Speaking.
Yeah. Hey, Chris. Glad to join you.
You do some science and some data to come up with some of these places that have become, I guess you could call them the cream of the crop. First off, how did homesnacks.net come up with the best places to live in Indiana?
As we typically do, you know, the criteria that we use is pretty unbiased. We essentially take all of the different categories of what it's like to live in a place, and we throw it into an algorithm, and we hit go, and it spits out an unbiased answer from best to worst based on things that people say they want in a hometown. So in this case, you know, we looked at places that had the lowest crime, the lowest unemployment rates, the best home values, the best cost of living, the lowest unemployment rates, and it kind of goes in and gives an unbiased look at what it's like to live in every single community in Indiana.
And what's amazing, I see on the list for the best places to live in Indiana for 2020 is the fact that in the least of the top 10, Indianapolis and Evansville and Fort Wayne, which are big cities in the state, aren't on the list this time, at least within the top 10. Tell us about the top 10 and how we end up getting 4 out of the top 10 communities out of Lake County.
It's a great place to be up there. It's kind of an area that a lot of people don't really talk about in Indiana. Everybody, of course, talks about the Indianapolis suburbs up there, which are great places to live. But up there in your neck of the woods, you know, you've got lower than average crime rates, pretty good schools. The poverty rates are pretty low. The income levels and the home values are all really good. Places like Munster and Dyer and St. John, in that neck of the woods, you know, those places are pretty good communities there in Indiana, and some of them moved up the rankings. For instance, you know, we saw Munster move up from 7 to 4, which, you know, isn't a huge jump, but it sort of is when you look at the fact that, you know, the crime numbers seem to have dipped down a little bit, and the home prices seem to have gone up a little bit, and the unemployment rate there, as well as pretty much the rest of America, went down a little bit. If you look at that from that perspective, up there in your area is a pretty good place to live. Mm-hmm.
Now, Dyer turned out to be number 5 on the list in the top 10. What did Dyer do, I guess, and where do they stand as like last year and how they made the improvement?
So last year, Dyer was 6, so they went up one spot. Nice little jump there. We have Dyer. We rank cities based on snackability, and that's our own kind of internal metric for determining whether or not a place is a good place to live. And mm-hmm. we get a lot of people who look, especially this time of year, at the beginning of the year, they're looking for places to move. Where can I take my family? Where's a great place? And they look at our website and they look at our snackability scores to determine whether or not it's a great place to live. It's sort of like our 5-star rating. But Dyer has a 9.5 out of 10 snackability score, which is almost the highest I've ever seen.
Wow.
You hardly ever see a 10 on our score. I mean, the home values are pretty good. The unemployment rates, pretty good. Dyer was called one of the 100 best places to live in the U.S. by CNN and Money Magazine, and so it doesn't really look like a lot has changed. I would say I lived in Indiana for 5 years, and I hadn't really heard much about Dyer before I started crunching these numbers. I had heard of Munster and some of the other areas up there, but Dyer is sort of a little place up there that I'm sure people that are listening right now are probably going, oh, God, now the secret's out. We're going to get a bunch of Californians trying to move here. But no, it's a great place to live.
St. John is also on the list this year. Again, it's on number 6 this time. So being not only a close relative, so to speak, as far as the Lake County communities are concerned, St. John's on the list as well, too. What was the things that made St. John stand out to get number 6 on the list this year?
Yeah, the unemployment rate's pretty much as low as you're going to get in the state. So pretty much a lot of people in the St. John area have great jobs. Home values are the third highest in the state, and that's an indication that a lot of people want to move there. Home values on desirability and interest. So if you've got high home values, that means people want to live there. $283,000 is the average home price there in St. John, which is great. And, you know, St. John actually has a 10 out of 10 snackability score. So that is as high as you're going to get pretty much in the entire nation, especially in Indiana. The population rate in St. John has grown by 8% over the last 15 years. So a lot of people want to move there. There's got to be a reason why, right?
That's right. That's right. We're talking with Nick Johnson with homesnacks.net. The website has come out once again with another, this time for 2020, Best Places to Live in Indiana list. And we're looking at the ones here in the top 10. And Crown Point is number 8 this time around. Tell us how Crown Point got on the list this year.
Well, Crown Point was 9th last year. They moved up to 8th. So that's pretty good for them. They're the 15th safest place in the state. There were only 6 violent crimes in the entire city last year. So with a population of 30,000 people, 6 violent crimes is really hardly anything. I mean, I know communities will have 6 violent crimes in a week of that size. You know, residents make a pretty decent income. The best part about Crown Point is that home values are actually far lower than they are in other communities. So it's a great opportunity for people that want to live in that area to live in a great community, but they don't want to pay for the cost of you know, the home prices in some of the more expensive communities in your area. I would say Crown Point's probably the cheapest, best place you can live in your entire area there.
And, of course, anyone who wants more information, take a look at the entire list and see how other cities in Indiana ranked as well on the best places to live in Indiana for 2020 list. Just go to homesnacks.net. Nick Johnson, thank you very much for the update, and thank you for showing not only your support as being a former Hoosier resident, but a chance to help get us on the map, so to speak.
Yes, people can also watch videos. We actually were just in Indiana and filmed a couple of travel videos. That's on our YouTube page. If they go to search Nick Johnson on YouTube, they can see what it's like in some of the other communities that we haven't mentioned in this report, kind of documented some of the communities in Indiana as well.
Thanks, Nick, for being with us today.
All right, Chris. Have a good one.
You would expect a geography professor to study geography, especially if he's working on a major project, but there is one geography professor at Valparaiso University that is not only researching geography, but the geography of country music. And it's kind of expanded from an earlier project that he has had. Mike Longan is with us to talk about his current work right now as he's continuing his work as a member of the VU faculty. And Professor Longan, thank you for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I understand that you kind of started out your work on geography looking into, I guess, what can best be described as the ex-urban culture here in Northwest Indiana, but you kind of added to it, and that's what you've gotten into now. Tell us first about the initial work that you did and how you've gotten country music all involved in it now.
I'm not from here. I'm from Colorado originally, and as I get to know the place, I was interested in kind of some of the cultural differences I experienced living here, and I thought I might do a study of the rural sort of ex-urban culture here in Northwest Indiana because I found it pretty fascinating. And so I proposed that, and that never really went very far, but in the process I got to know this region's country music scene. At the time it was centered at D.C.'s Country Junction, and taught a class in rural geography, and used country music as a way to understand the rural, and the research emerged out of that.
When you get country music involved in this, whether it's local or regional or even national, I guess, because I understand that you've kind of taken this stretch even further outside the Northwest Indiana, but where do you find country music seem to best fit into what we have here in Northwest Indiana as our overall culture?
We have a pretty robust country music scene here in Northwest Indiana. I mean, I guess the way I got introduced to it was the radio station that's ubiquitous pretty much in a local shop, very locally oriented radio station. And so I think country music is a part of this region. And, you know, there's a pretty long history of country performers coming through with the Porter County Fair and with D.C.'s Country Junction for the while it was open. And, you know, even before that, Chicago itself could have been the country music capital with a WLS barn dance. And of course, country music migrated to this region as people from Appalachia moved up looking for work in the factories here in this region historically. Yeah. So
I suppose in the same way that the jazz seemed to evolve around Chicago because we had blacks that came up from the South to look for better work up that way too. So it's all the same, and it doesn't matter whether it happens to be a syncopated music or whether it happens to be country music. It's still music.
Definitely.
Now, you've been able to go into this here in Northwest Indiana in particular, and looking into this geography of country music. I understand that you've had an opportunity to branch out around the world almost. How did you end up doing your study work into this topic in Australia, of all places?
I traveled to Australia quite a few, I guess it was 2006,
yeah.
And then I wanted to go back and you know, one thing I noticed is that country music was on all the radio stations, or there was a country music radio station wherever I went in Australia. It's popular there. One of my chapters in my book will be on country music festivals. So in 2016, I went to the Tamworth Country Music Festival in Tamworth, Australia, which is in New South Wales, and experienced that. I was about the only American I met, other than some of the performers, but It was really cool. It was all very good. The level of talent there is amazing. Yeah. Music is great, and I'm a fan of a lot of country music performers from Australia.
Who were you some of the performers from America that you met while you were over there?
No one in particular. There were a couple. They were not big performers. I don't remember exactly who they were. Mm-hmm. I remember more of the Australian performers, actually, like Adam Brand and Casey Chambers, being two of my favorites there.
I know you've also been able to take this in your scholarly work a step further by having a chance to check out the documentary that Ken Burns is working on recently about country music. Tell us about what that documentary is all about and your impression of it.
Yeah, it's a good history of country music. It was very, very long, but at the same time, it had to be pretty selective. So I think it gives a great overview of the history of country music, and probably has some surprising revelations about it for people that aren't necessarily familiar with country music at all. And I think it shows that it is a valuable part of our culture. Mm-hmm. And I enjoyed the documentary. I thought it was well done. There's so much more to say about country music, though. And
we're talking with Mike Longan. He's a geography professor at Valparaiso University. He's been researching the geography of country music, and of course you have students involved in your research. Tell us how they fit into it.
In the past, I've had a few students that were interested in both geography and country music come help me out with the research. I had a couple students that, when I very first got started, we went down to Nashville to go to the Country Music Hall of Fame. They have the archive, the Frist archive there, which has all kinds of information. So I started there with my research, and I brought two students with me, and we had a good day or two looking at the archives there and checking out Nashville. And then I had some students help me later date with some surveys that I did locally, asking people about their relationship to country music.
So. Now, since you've got your research already underway in this, and you branched out not only from Northwest Indiana, but around the world, apparently, where's it to go now as you get things together?
Well, I've got a lot of data and a lot of ideas put together, and I've been presenting at the International Country Music Conference in Nashville for the last 6 years. So I've got a lot of stuff sort of put together, so the next thing to do is to get it all into a book form.
I was going to ask if you were going to become a scholarly author of the subject, if this is something that appealed to you.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
We'll look forward to a book coming out here about the geography of country music. And, of course, it all got started by studying culture here in Northwest Indiana. We thank you, Professor Longan, for being with us to talk about it today.
Thank you very much.
Mike Longan is a Valparaiso University geography professor. He's studying the geography of country music that started out here in Northwest Indiana and now is ranched around the world. The Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. is considered a vital figure of the modern era. He was a pivotal figure in the civil rights movement, and his charismatic leadership has inspired men and women, young and old, across the country and around the world. And coming up on Monday of next week is the annual observance of Martin Luther King Jr. Day, which is, of course, Monday. And Purdue University Northwest is going to host its 25th annual Martin Luther King Jr. Community Celebration Breakfasts, beginning Monday and continuing on Tuesday, the 21st, on campuses at Westville and Hammond. And to tell you more about the programs coming up and the dynamic keynote speaker who will be speaking at both events, we have Laura Odom. She's the Associate Director of Purdue University Northwest's Office of Equity, Diversity, and Inclusion. Laura, thanks for joining us on Regionally Speaking today.
My pleasure. Thanks for the invitation.
Well, first, if you will, talk in your feelings about Dr. King and why he is certainly one of the most important figures of the modern era, as he's been described by many people.
Well, definitely, he is a strong leader in the civil rights movement. He stood up and spoke for what's right for all, regardless of our race, and he spoke up for the segregation that was happening for African Americans and for other minorities as well. So he's definitely a strong leader, and Purdue University Northwest is proud to be able to honor his legacy by hosting the celebrations that are free and open to the public. It's a chance for us to remember, experience, and honor the life and legacy of Dr. King.
Now, we should mention that the first breakfast of the two is going to be on Monday, January 20th, which is Martin Luther King Jr. Day. It'll be at the Westville campus beginning at 8:30 in the morning. And as we mentioned at the beginning of our conversation, that both of the days will be honored with some very special comments from a very dynamic keynote speaker. Tell us what the speaker is going to bring to not only the table as far as her views about Northwest Indiana, but about Dr. King in general.
Sure. Well, we're excited to be able to have Dr. Vanessa Allen McLeod. She's the president and chief executive officer of the Urban League of Northwest Indiana as our keynote speaker. She's going to be talking with the guests that attend the events on courageous conversations that can lead to change. So she's going to share with us some different things to keep in mind and even talk about Dr. King's legacy and share some helpful tidbits that I think that can move us more toward meeting Dr. King's vision. So we're excited to have her as our keynote speaker.
We note that even though there's going to be a breakfast affair on the Westfield campus on Martin Luther King Jr. Day on January the 20th, on the following day, on Tuesday the 21st, it's a very special reception that is going to be held at the Hammond campus at Purdue University Northwest. The same speaker with Dr. Vanessa Allen McLeod speaking as well, and is likely to bring anything different to the table for those who attend on the Hammond campus.
The program is going to be the exact same. The only difference is because the start time is 10:30 and it ends around noon, we're going to be eating on the back end, so we'll be holding a reception, mm-hmm. whereas Monday we'll be having a breakfast and be eating on the front end.
When you note this is the 25th annual observance of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s legacy that he has left behind for us to look to, the messages that he has passed on over the years, is there anything in particular that you and your colleagues at Purdue University Northwest remember from not only the past breakfasts or events that have happened on campus, but ones that you're hoping to have?
I definitely know that we tend to have a good turnout, and we talk about Dr. King's legacy and how we can focus on becoming a more peaceful, moving more towards his nonviolent philosophy, and just really creating an environment where everyone feels welcome and respected regardless of our differences. So it's a chance for us to reflect upon what he stood for and what we need to continue to do to move towards his vision.
I should ask if you know of and your colleagues at Purdue Northwest have no doubt told you about some of the past speakers that have been on previous programs. Dr. Allen McLeod is certainly one of the more dynamic ones that you can think of. Have been any others folks here in Northwest Indiana that have been able to speak to Dr. King and their thoughts about him?
Yes, we've had former professors, we've had lawyers. Last year we had Judge Curiel. So we've had a variety of different speakers represent Dr. King's legacy. So we're really excited to have Vanessa here with the local community attend the event.
Now, if anybody was interested to find out more about what Purdue University Northwest has to say about Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., certainly with the observance of Martin Luther King Jr. Day on Monday the 20th, or just about the programs in general that are coming up on campus this year, where can they find out more now?
Sure. Individuals can go online and visit pnw.edu's website, and there'll be information. There is information currently out there about the MLK celebration. Something else I may like to add is mm-hmm. that we encourage guests to bring new socks to the event because we're going to be donating them to the local community and abroad. I'd also like to thank our sponsors. This event would not be possible without the generous donations from our premier sponsors, Horizon Bank, NIPSCO, Herald Argus, News Dispatch, Purdue University Northwest Office of Equity, Diversity, and Inclusion. Our gold donors are Blue Chip Casino, Hotel, and Spa, Michigan City Human Rights Commission, Sinai Temple, Visit Michigan City LaPorte Convention and Visitors Bureau. Our silver donors are First Source Bank and Unity Foundation of LaPorte County. And our bronze donors are Alpha Kappa Alpha Sorority Incorporated, LaPorte County, National Advancement of Colored People, Life Changes, Michigan City Commission on the Social Status of African American Males, and Sandra Craig.
When it's time to get things organized for another year of the events in particular, when you get to approach all these organizations and businesses that have shown their support for the programs, and like this year, for example, do these folks have anything interesting to say why they want to get involved?
They definitely are showing that they like to support the event because of the diversity and inclusion that's represented, because they like to share with community that they also take pride in encouraging diversity and inclusion and making sure that all are welcome regardless of our differences.
Now, if anybody would like more information here about the programs coming up, where can they find out now?
Visit the MLK website on the Purdue Northwest website. I'm sorry, www.pnw.edu, and there'll be there's information about the Martin Luther King celebration online.
And we can look to that then. Thank you very much, Laura, for being with us to tell us about the events coming up on Monday and Tuesday of next week, continuing the celebration of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s life and the message that he has left for us as well. The 25th year for such events here on the campus at Purdue Northwest. Thank you for being with us today.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
Laura Odom is the Associate Director for the Office of Equity, Diversity, and Inclusion at Purdue University Northwest at the Westville and the Hammond campuses. At the State House last evening, Governor Eric Holcomb proposed a new plan to free up state dollars for teacher pay in his State of the State address, which you could have heard right here on Lakeshore Public Radio last evening. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith tells us more about this particular plan that the governor's proposed to be implemented this year. Well, it could be, but the governor's decided to wait for 2021.
Republicans insist that further efforts to boost educators' salaries must wait until the 2021 budget session. Holcomb's new plan, targeted for next year, would use one-time dollars to pay down part of a teacher pension fund.
In turn, $50 million a year will be generated to redirect to teacher pay.
The governor also has a new plan to make adoptions easier and quicker. He's creating an adoption unit, a first for Indiana, at the Department of Child Services,
whose sole purpose and focus will be assisting family case managers with finding permanent homes for children.
Administration officials say the new adoption unit should be up and running this year. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith at the State House.
In reaction to the State of the State address last evening, Republican Party leaders were cautiously optimistic about the governor's new plan to free up dollars for teacher pay. And that's while Democrats say, show me the money. Holcomb's proposal, as you heard, would take one-time dollars to pay down part of a teacher pension fund, and that would free up $50 million a year, which the governor says should be directed toward boosting educator salaries. But the governor wants to wait till 2021 to enact the plan, and Senate Democratic leader Tim Lannon is wondering why.
You know, it's the old, what, I'll gladly pay you Tuesday for a hamburger today, right? No, pay me now. Let's get the money on the table.
Republican leaders are steadfast, though. No new money this year for teacher pay. And House Speaker Brian Bosma sides with the governor, saying that it has to wait to the 2021 budget.
To commit $250 million today on a fiscal forecast that doesn't exist yet next year, I don't think would be a wise use of state resources.
Republicans are spending new money this session on the cash payments for higher education capital projects that were approved in this past year's budget. Eli Lilly is announcing plans for offering less expensive versions of two of the company's insulin pens. That's 8 months after introducing a reduced-price liquid insulin. State and federal lawmakers have criticized drug companies like Lilly for a jump in insulin costs in recent years. The company plans to sell discounted versions of a quick pen and a junior quick pen for 50% less than the current list price. Both pens will be available by the middle of April. The insulin will carry a list price of about $265 for a package of five. In a news release about the topic, Lilly says that the discounted insulins are identical molecules to the branded versions. And the company says also that because most insurance plans are providing copays for chronic medications that are lower than the list price, people should ask their pharmacist if those options would reduce their out-of-pocket costs. Indiana University has developed a tool for the federal government to help developers invest in opportunity zones that are supposed to boost in low-income areas. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Samantha Horton tells us that while some say that the zones don't help those in need, one federal official says the tool will help areas in critical need.
The web-based map shows the median income, population, and much more in each area across the country. These opportunity zones have come under scrutiny after some developers invested in up-and-coming areas or built luxury apartments instead of low-income housing. U.S. Assistant Secretary of Commerce for Economic Development John Fleming says he doesn't believe the tool will be misused.
They're going to be looking for low-hanging fruit, of course. But as they improve and come up with better and better business models, I think you'll see that their investments, as they grow more comfortable with this concept, will go into more and more challenging areas.
Fleming says he believes the tool will make data more easily available and help draw more private investment into opportunity zones. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Samantha Horton.
A $1.5 million gift to Gleaners Food Bank of Indiana is going to help serve more people across the state. Gleaners President and CEO John Elliott says the organization's strategically focusing at the intersection of hunger and health, as he put it, and it aims to help increase the amount of food that is delivered as well as the nutritional value of that food.
It matters, the food that our neighbors eat, and frankly, correcting the problem of the food they don't eat.
Elliott says many people are facing numerous challenges, and he says food assistance can help families toward a path to self-sufficiency.
Let's get them to self-sufficiency. Let's figure out how we get that family taking care of themselves. They don't want to be in that situation of poverty and struggle and challenge, so...
Anthem was going to provide the funding over the next 3 years for the project in central Indiana, and that includes senior shopping and mobile pantries. About 17% of residents in Marion County are facing food insecurity these days, and here in northwest Indiana, it's just about as much. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you for joining us tomorrow on Regionally Speaking. We have comments from our reporters, Sharon Jackson from Lakeshore Public Radio, and our colleague Michael Puente. And Joseph Pete from The Times will be with us as well, too, to talk about the stories that he's offered up in print and online. We'll also have a Methodist Hospitals representative talking about their very first community forum of the year. And we hope you'll join us.